Okay, the lecture today is an important lecture because it's on the immediate origins of the Second World War. Now, why is this such an important topic? It's because we're trying to deal with this basic conceptual problem of what makes for war. And people assume that, wars begin with acts of aggression. They're started by one side or another for aggressive purposes. And there's never been a leader as aggressive as Hitler, most people would agree. Nazi foreign policy was the most aggressive foreign policy of any major power in modern history, right? And so if the coming of the Second World War in Europe in September 1939 is not to be understood as an act of aggression, pure and simple, if it's to be understood in more complex terms as the outcome of a political process in which the initiative was not taken solely by the Germans, but it's to be understood in more interactive terms, where political considerations, power considerations, were shaping the behavior of both sides. Well, that's a very important conclusion, which would have a very direct bearing on how we understand international politics as a whole. If the aggressive theory doesn't adequately explain the coming of the Second World War, then you really have to wonder about it in general, given how aggressive the Nazi foreign policy was, right? And this kind of relates to the kind of basic points that have emerged from our analysis of international politics in the interwar period, an analysis which emphasizes political considerations, how the policies of all these powers were shaped by these structural forces, how there was more continuity between the 20s and the 30s than we had been led to believe, because the basic structural problem was constant across time. The problem of German power, of Germany being held down by a set of artificial constraints, the Versailles constraints, that there were no kind of natural balances to German power, which in themselves would keep Germany from overwhelming the rest of Europe. It's like the system of the interwar period is very different even from what you had before World War I. You know, there's no Russian counterweight to German power. Russia is pushed back behind a wall of hostile East European states. That, you know, United States, which had contributed in such a dramatic way to the victory in World War I, the Americans have now turned their backs on Europe, essentially. And all that's constraining Germany is basically France. You know, Britain is only half committed to the defense of the status quo. The British have turned against the treaty settlement. The British are in favor of, you know, removing the constraints on German power. Right? And France by herself is not strong enough to kind of keep Germany down. So there's this constant chipping away at the Versailles system in the 20s. It becomes much more overt in the 1930s. The basic problem is constant across time. Very important point. Okay? Not only that, but it's not as though these European problems are all there are to the story, because Britain and France are great world powers. Each of them has a huge empire, major interests, both in Africa and in East Asia. And as it becomes increasingly clear that Britain and France have their hands full dealing with Germany and Europe, you know, given that they can't count on Russian or American cooperation to keep Germany down, and that Germany senses the weakness of the Western powers and thus has an incentive to resist the Versailles system in the 1920s under a democratic regime as in the 1930s under the Nazis. As that becomes increasingly clear, you know, that the Western powers are overextended, they therefore become vulnerable to challenges to their preeminence in other parts of the world, most notably in East Asia, you know. Japan is encouraged to, you know, develop more of an independent position in the world by creating an empire in East Asia. not just in Korea, but in northern China. And you have the Manchurian incident, so-called, 1931. Again, don't know, before the Nazis come to power. The Italians are encouraged by the weakness of Britain and France to kind of move more energetically toward the creation of an East African empire with the war against the Ethiopian in 1935. These things don't just happen, you know, totally independently. They're very much a product of the overall political conjuncture. Both Italy and Japan sense Western weakness, the fact that the Western powers are overextended, that they're not going to be able to sustain major quarrels with Italy and Japan because of their preoccupation with Germany. And so Italy and Japan, they sense they can get away with things, right? And this creates this problem for the West. How are you going to deal with this? If you're on the left and you believe that peace should be based in collective security and on League of Nations, then you feel a certain compulsion, regardless of the power political conjuncture, to come down on Japan and Ethiopia. But on the other hand, the people on the right say, well, you can't really come down on them too hard, because that would drive them over to the side of Germany. We have to kind of conserve our resources for dealing with the German problem. Right? So Britain and France are kind of divided about it as to how to deal with Japanese and Italian aggression. And basically, they pursue this middle policy that's neither fish nor fowl, you know, enough to alienate Japan and Italy, but not enough to sustain a regime of collective security. And all of this is compounded by these problems that we associate with the Depression. You know, part of the reason why Japan especially kind of wants to create an empire in East Asia is that in the world of the 1930s, a world where all the major powers are suffering from depression, everyone tries to deal with depression by, you know, pursuing protectionist economic policies, preserving their own market as an outlet for their own industry, discriminating against outsiders, you know, the most protectionist tariff legislation in American history. The Hawley Smoot tariff was adopted during this period. Japan feels itself kind of squeezed out of the international trading regime, and the alternative to that is a more autarkic system based on Japanese preeminence in East Asia. Right? So, you know, as far as Britain and France are concerned, you have this basic problem in a period of depression. You know, the economy isn't generating as much of a surplus as it had in the prosperity of the late 1920s. You know, output has shrunk, but on the other hand, the demands on the treasury have increased, because you can't allow people to starve. You have to provide for certain social welfare provisions. So the resources that the government controls have shrunk, tax revenues shrink, and yet the demands on the budget increase for social welfare purposes. You can't make up the gap with inflationary finance by running budget deficits, because the fear is that once you allow the inflationary demons out of the bottle, then the economic consequences will be disastrous. You have to, you know, restore business confidence by pursuing a sound money policy. You know, it's those pre-Keynesian days, and so there's just not enough money left in the pot to sustain a viable rearmament program. And that's compounded by the common belief that arms races cause wars. You don't want to get involved in an arms race with Germany, because look at the pre-World War I period. It's the general notion at that time that the First World War came about in large measure because of the arms race, in quotes, that existed before the First World War. You don't want to do that again. So all those structural factors played a kind of key role in shaping the policies of the great powers, and in particular in, in shaping European great power politics in the early 1930s. Right? Not enough in themselves to give Germany a sense of a total green light, a total free hand. The Germans are worried enough about what Britain and France might do if Germany, you know, moved in too direct a way to overthrow the treaty system and build up its military power and so on. And so the sense on the part of the Germans was that they were going to have to go through a danger zone during this period when they were still vulnerable to invasion from the West if they moved ahead in too dramatic a way in building up their military power. So to kind of steer Germany through the danger zone, it was the task of German diplomacy to minimize the risk of an intervention. And so we saw how Germans in the first part of the Nazi period, 33 to 35, were moving ahead carefully, slowly, you know, testing the waters before they moved. All these measures to show that the Nazi regime was respectable, isolating Germany's adversaries from each other, trying, you know, the non-aggression pact with Poland, the Anglo-German naval agreement of 1935, all these measures to kind of, you know, limit the amount of resistance that Germany would encounter as she moved ahead, right? And all this culminates in the German remilitarization of the Rhineland in March of 1936, the great watershed date in the story of the origins of the Second World War in the 1930s, because this changes a lot. Once the Rhineland is secure and the French are can't even in principle contemplate invading Germany in the event that the Germans move east and begin to build up their power at the expense of their eastern neighbors, Poland, Czechoslovakia, and so on, the French can't do much. And this is, this is compounded by the fact that France suffers from military weakness. The generation that normally would have been of draft age in the early mid-1930s, it did not come into existence because the fathers of that generation had been killed off during the war. You know, the French have this expression, les années creuses, the empty years. There would be too few young men of draft age in the mid-1930s, because of this demographic problem. Germany didn't suffer from this to anything like the same extent. The French, seeing that this was coming and seeing that their army would be of limited size, decided that they would deal with this problem not by creating a strong offensive force, which is just kind of out of the question, that was capable of invading Germany in the event that Germany moved east, but rather putting their military resources into the construction of a strong line of defenses, the Maginot Line. Again, decision 1929, before the Depression, let alone before the coming to power of the Nazis. Evidence of the French realized that their basic security problem had not been resolved by the diplomacy of the Locarno. That possibility is removed. 1936, the Germans violate the Treaty of Locarno that they themselves had signed voluntarily. It's not simply of a violation of Versailles, it's a violation of Locarno. Right? The Germans were now moving ahead more dramatically. Now that they were secure in the West, they could move toward building up their military power in a much more forthright way, mobilizing, as much in the way of military resources as their economy could stand. And as German power, was clearly on the rise, and it was clear that Britain and France weren't going to do anything about it, you find various shifts in the policy of other countries. you know, for example, the shift of Italian policy away from alignment with the West toward alignment with Germany, the shift in Belgian policy away from the alliance with France to a policy of neutrality. All these things weaken the position of the Western powers. They strengthen the position of Germany, create the sense that, you know, Germany is on the move. Germany now has the initiative. You know, the Western powers have little choice but to accept what the Germans are doing. Okay? Well, how do you deal with this situation? The situation that confronted them from March 1936 on. Well, just sit back passively and accept it? That was not the policy of the British. What sort of policy did they adopt? Well, this policy of appeasement, the famous policy of appeasement, associated with the British Prime Minister from 1937 on, Neville Chamberlain. And for years after the Second World War, the term appeasement, you know, was like, it was treated like dirt. Yeah, the notion of appeasement, well, this was evidence of moral weakness, of the cravenness of the West, right? You want to understand the coming of the Second World War? Well, the fact that Hitler was so evil, well, that was a big part of the story. But also, look how morally craven the Western powers were, how you know, pathetic they were in moral terms, that instead of doing the right thing, which was to stand up to German aggression, they adopted this policy of appeasing Hitler, you know, just trying to buy off Hitler, you know, and prevent him from, you know, threatening them, when it was clear, as great men like Churchill were pointing out at the time, that what you had to do was kind of stand up to the aggressor, you know, avoid anything that smacked of appeasement, right? You know, those ideas had a huge resonance in the West, and especially in America during the Cold War period. Right? The shadow of appeasement lay over U.S. Foreign policy during the Cold War. Right? And Churchill, great British Prime Minister of the period of the Second World War, after the war, and he was thrown out by the British electorate at the very end of the war, right in the middle of the Potsdam Conference, in fact, in July 1945, before the war with Japan was even over. Churchill wrote his great history of the Second World War, and his the first volume in that history is called The Gathering Storm, which is a whole the history of the coming of the war, especially in the 1930s. That came out in 1948, right, and it basically established this conventional view that moral factors were of central importance in shaping the course of events that led to the outbreak of war in 1939. If only the Western powers had the moral strength to stand up to this kind of evil Nazi force, things would have been totally different. Very important line of argument, because it bears on these central issues that we're concerned with in this course. Yeah, it's a moral interpretation of the coming of the war, not political factors, not power considerations, and so on. Okay. Eventually, the British documents were released, and as scholars went through British and then French documents relating to the origins of the war, and a very, very different picture began to emerge. It's like, instead of, you know, being utterly contemptuous of the appeasement policy, scholars came to view it as more or less inevitable as a result of the shifting power political conjuncture. I put a couple of articles on the course website that you may want to look at to kind of reflect that changing historiographical perspective. One of them is this article by Paul Schrader, you know, very famous, important diplomatic historian, you know, looking back in Munich. And this passage will kind of give you the flavor of that new way of looking at these things that emerged as historians, you know, went through all this new evidence and saw things through the eyes of people at the time, much more sympathetic to the appeasement policy than the earlier view that we associate with Churchill. And Schrader writes, if one begins to tot up all the plausible motivations for appeasement, fear and horror of another war, Britain's state of military unpreparedness, fear for the British economy and the empire, the unprepared state of public opinion, the isolationism of the Dominions and the United States, lack of confidence in France, lack of interest in Central Europe, failure to understand Hitler and Nazism, fear and distrust of the Soviet Union and communism, the absence of a viable alternative presented either by the conservative opposition or labor, and more. One sees that these are far more than enough to explain it. It was massively overdetermined. Any other policy in 1938 would have been an astounding, almost inexplicable divergence from the norm. Well, that's a very different view from the view that people had had before. Okay? So how is appeasement itself to be understood? Again, the earlier notion was that it was like just ostrich-like, you know, burying your head in the sand. I don't want to look at things. I just don't want to get involved. Kicking the ball down the road, you know, hoping that if Hitler was given what he was asking for, he would be content. A very naive view, you know, those sorts of notions, very, you know, passive policy. In fact, again, as historians went through the evidence, a very different picture emerged. You know, it's not passive at all, this Chamberlain policy, the policy that was instituted in 1937. It's a very active policy. The whole idea is we want to engineer these changes so as to get the Germans to accept the status quo. But the changes would have to take place peacefully, and there would have to be a limit to how far Germany would go. Right? Yes, the principle of self-determination should be applied so that territories that were inhabited by Germans, if they wished, could become part of the Reich. But beyond that, you couldn't go. And all these changes would have to be made peacefully, although the term peacefully was interpreted fairly broadly. Okay? But you couldn't just sit on your hands and give Hitler a free hand to carve out a great empire in the East, because if that happened and German strength was allowed to increase by leaps and bounds and Germany was able to control all the resources of Europe up to the Urals, then Germany would be so strong that Britain and France would become essentially satellites of Germany. They would lose their independence. They couldn't hold their own against this massive German colossus if such a colossus was allowed to come into being. Okay? And so there had to be limits. And the fact that there would be limits was made clear to the Germans. Okay? There's a very interesting book that came out. It's called Chamberlain and Appeasement by a British historian named R.A.C. Parker. Again, this is one of the main historical studies that was based on all this new evidence that was made available, especially like in the 60s and 70s. And this is what Parker has to say about Chamberlain. Chamberlainite appeasement, it's true, was not a feeble policy of surrender and unlimited retreat. Chamberlain thought war futile and rejected it, but never pursued peace at any price. His policy meant intervention in continental Europe to induce Hitler's Germany to insist only on expansion so limited that it would not threaten the safety or independence of the United Kingdom. In retrospect, this appears a bold, venturesome policy, certain, given the ambitions of Hitler, to lead to an Anglo-German war. Very, you know, that's a very different view of appeasement from what we had been led to believe. Okay. And it's important to realize that because it helps us to understand the story that led to the coming of war in September of 1939. Hitler's initial goal had been to reach an accommodation with Britain. No wish to destroy the British Empire. The British Empire, after all, meant that an Anglo-Saxon nation, you know, Nordic nation, European nation, was able to be a master race, controlling all these subject races in, you know, in Africa and South Asia and so on. This is a good thing from the standpoint of the Nazis. And the big mistake, according to Hitler, that his predecessors in Imperial Germany had made, had been to alienate the British. I mean, and you know, Hitler was actually absolutely right about this. What's the central error of German policy before 1914? Taking on the three next most important powers in Europe all at the same time. You know, you don't want to do that. You want to isolate your enemies so that you can deal with them one by one. If they, if you allow them to form a bloc, they'll overwhelm you. Germany isn't strong enough to take on the rest of Europe all at the same time. So you got to isolate your adversaries, right? And that meant reaching an accommodation with the British. Being willing, in fact, even to guarantee the British Empire. You know, and in exchange for which the British would give Germany a free hand to do as she wished against Soviet Russia, a free hand in the East. Free hand in the East, right? And when he sent one of his top advisors, Ribbentrop, over to London as the German ambassador, he says, Ribbentrop, bring me back the British alliance. But because of the nature of British policy, the fact that Britain, for strategic reasons of her own, could not allow Germany to become that strong because that would mean an end to British independence. You know, for strict balance of power reasons of that sort, it soon became clear in the course of 1937 that Hitler's goals vis-a-vis Britain were unrealizable. I mean, Hitler couldn't believe it. You know, say, these people, they wouldn't oppose me when I was weak. Now they're going to oppose me when I'm strong. You know, it's irrational for the British to pursue the policy that they're pursuing, to put limits on how far we can go, especially since the writ of British power doesn't reach to Eastern Europe. What are the British going to do if we move against Poland, right? Blockade us? What good will that do? Right? Britain and France couldn't do too much to stop Germany. They had missed their opportunity. And so Hitler felt like, well, it looks like war with the Western powers is inevitable. Conclusion he reaches in the course of 1937. War with Britain and France is inevitable. But throughout this period, you find him saying, we want to put it off. We don't want it right away. War is inevitable, but let's put it off until German power is really built up. Because we can build up our power, given the Nazi control of the German economy and our ability to basically take all of the economic surplus that's being created by the revival of the German economy and plow it into war production, whereas Britain and France couldn't go that route at all. Right? Let's put it off to a point where we're strong enough to take them on. And what is that point? In all of these German documents from this period, you find Hitler referring to the 1943 to 1945 period as the period when there would be the showdown with Britain and France. That's when there would be the great war with the Western powers. One of these key documents is the record of a meeting he held with his top military advisors, leery about a too aggressive a German policy. Because, you know, Germany, her inherent resources aren't all that great. There are limits on it. There's a meeting he had with his top military advisors in November of 1937. And the what was said at this meeting was recorded by Hitler's adjutant. His name was Hosbach, Colonel Hosbach. And so this is called the Hosbach Memorandum of November of 1937. And Hitler begins by talking about, Now, Britain and France are what he called hate-inspired adversaries. In other words, their policy is irrational. It doesn't make sense. A war with them is inevitable, but let's put it off. And in the meantime, before we have to face a big war with the Western powers, you know, a serious war in this 43 to 45 period, what we got to do is kind of clear the decks in the East and strengthen our position in the East, remove enemies in the East, you know, annex the resources of countries like you know, Austria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, all of Southeastern Europe, indeed, so that Germany would be in a position to face the war with the Western powers with some confidence. And as if Germany moved against the these countries in the East, you know, Britain and France, they wouldn't intervene. They might say they're going to intervene, but they don't have the military wherewithal to do anything about it. Right? You know, they're weak. Yeah. Even so, you want to do what you can to minimize the chance of intervention by making it easier for the Western powers to back off from their commitments. And to do that, you want to kind of play on these basic principles, moral principles, that lay at the heart of Western policy. Above all, the Wilsonian principle, self-determination. Here you have countries like Austria that are inhabited by German-speaking people. You know, it's like, you know, policy that looked toward the annexation of Austria. How could the West really oppose that if that's what the Austrians themselves want? You know, if this whole notion of people of the same nationality, they should all come together in the same state, well, that's a basic Western principle. How can they oppose that? And so you find a quickening of German policy vis-a-vis Austria. Not a policy that looked toward military conquest, so much as a policy that looked toward a political settlement where the local Nazis would come to power in Austria, and then once they gained power in Austria, they would engineer a voluntary reunion of Austria with the German Reich. And there was a very strong Nazi element within Austria. They weren't the dominant element as of yet. And there was a lot of particularism in Austria. The kind of government, which is by no means a democratic government, was averse to allowing Austria to be submerged within the German Reich. But, you know, the threat of intervention, the threat of, German power could be wielded in such a way as to push the Austrian government into allowing the local Nazis in Austria to have a greater and greater share in the control of the state, with the notion that there would eventually be a natural annexation of union of Austria with the Reich. It was called the Anschluss, the union of Austria with Germany. Okay, but the Austrians saw what the Germans were doing, and they took countermeasures to kind of preserve the independence of Austria, challenging Hitler in a very direct way. You know, Hitler thought that this was insane for them to kind of take on Germany, say they were so weak, and they didn't have any support, especially now that, thanks to the Ethiopian business, Mussolini's relations with the Western powers had been destroyed, and Mussolini had been, you know, moving more and more toward accommodation with Germany. And if Austria was isolated and the Western powers couldn't do anything to help them, then it was insane for them to kind of have this sort of showdown. All this business came to a head when the Austrian chancellor, his name is Schuschnigg, you know, called for a plebiscite on the whole issue of the independence of Austria. And Hitler saw this for what it was, namely a fundamental challenge to his basic policy. And then, started, basically slamming the fist on the table and demanding that this not be done, and in fact insisting that the Nazis come to power in Austria and that the Germans be invited in to kind of annex Austria into the Reich. The invasion of March of 1938 was improvised. It wasn't something that Hitler had intended all along. It wasn't like there was a clear timetable when it was Austria's turn. You know, it was very much a result of kind of unpredicted events that were somewhat distasteful to the Nazi regime, because they didn't want the mailed fist to be shown as clearly as it was. They wanted a more political process to run its course, right? But just look at the map. Look at the map over here. You see what happens when Austria is annexed into the German state? The Bohemian heartland of Czechoslovakia, the Czech heartland around Prague and so on. This is now surrounded on three sides. It's clear it's Czechoslovakia's turn. And once again, Hitler plays the card of national self-determination. Because the mountainous fringe of Czechoslovakia, an area called the Sudeten Mountains, was inhabited by German-speaking people, the Sudeten Germans. And these people had been particularly hard hit by the Depression. Their basic party representing them the Sudeten German Party was essentially a branch of the Nazi Party. And Hitler was able to use the demand that the Sudeten Germans be granted the right of self-determination to drive a wedge between Czechoslovakia and the Western powers. The Czechs had an alliance with France. The British said that if this led France to go to war against Germany, Britain would be into the war on the side of France. But of course, this is the last thing the British want. And so you have the second crisis of 1938, which is the Czech crisis, tensions rise. Hitler is making these demands that the Sudeten Nazis be, or Sudeten Germans be allowed to exercise their right of self-determination. You allow them to do so and cede all those areas to Germany, then the rest of Czechoslovakia is going to be totally at the mercy of Germany, because mountainous areas are much more easily defensible than flat areas. And the Czechs, the only chance of the Czechoslovak state for survival was its ability to take advantage of those mountainous defenses and keep the Germans at bay, because a lot of Germany's military resources would be diverted to the war with the West, right? But once the Sudeten Mountains are ceded to Germany, the Bohemian Plain would then be at the mercy of Germany, and the remnant of the Czechoslovak state would be at Germany's mercy. And so you have this whole issue that, you know, the Germans insist on the right of self-determination. How can you deny them that? Chamberlain says, well, let's do it peacefully. So he flies off to Germany to meet Hitler, and there are three meetings between Chamberlain and Hitler during the Czech crisis. First meeting at Hitler's mountain retreat in the Alps above Munich called Berchtesgaden. And Hitler says, well, there should be a plebiscite and any areas where 50% of the population votes to join Germany, they should be ceded to Germany. And Chamberlain thinks, well, I think we can make a deal on that basis. Goes back and he gets support of the French and the rest of the British cabinet to support that rather than go to war. And he thinks he has a deal. He flies back to meet Hitler at Godesberg in the Rhineland. And Hitler says, our terms have actually gone up. And what we're demanding now is that the Czechs immediately turn over all the areas that he's marked on a map that he turns over to Chamberlain. Well, this is just not even the charade of a negotiated settlement, of a reasonable settlement. Hitler's goal is to up the ante so that there's no peaceful settlement. He wants to raise his terms to the point where the Czechs can't accept them, but Britain and France aren't going to go to war with Czechoslovakia, because he, on behalf of Czechoslovakia. Because what he wants is a little war against Czechoslovakia so that he can annex all of Czechoslovakia without actually having a war with Britain and France. So can you pitch your demands at such a level that the Czechs won't accept them, but Britain and France in final analysis will? Right. Chamberlain doesn't like this, but he was personally disposed to accept these terms. But he goes back to England, and there's this big revolt among his colleagues. And the key figure here is the British Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax, who says, no, we can't accept this. And Hitler had reached the hard line of British resistance. And Hitler doesn't want a war. So he gives way, right? Hitler comes to view Munich as a defeat, because what happens is there's a third conference. As people seem to get ready for war, the Germans get the Italians to propose a conference of Britain, France, with Germany and Italy to kind of settle the Czech thing. And Hitler reduces his demands to below what they had been at Gottesburg, still quite high, but enough to kind of get a settlement. There's no German war against Czechoslovakia. Hitler feels cheated by the Munich Agreement. He does not view Munich as a great victory, as we've all been led to believe. He views it as a defeat, and in fact, pays a certain price in internal political terms, because there are various elements in the Nazi elite who are just stunned by the fact that Hitler has given way. This is, Chamberlain is delighted. He says, Hitler has missed the bus. He's delighted by Munich. Hitler has missed the bus. Why is this? Because in Chamberlain's view, if war had broken out in 1938, Britain and France would not have had much of a chance. British and French rearmament had barely begun, especially in the whole area of the production of fighter aircraft that could shield Britain from German bombers. Right? That's a big difference between 38 and 39. This is one of the things that made it possible for Britain to win the Battle of Britain during the war, where British fighter aircraft was strong enough to prevent the Germans from gaining control of the skies and launching a successful invasion of the British Isles. Okay? So you have the whole Czech business settled without a war. Okay? And that sets the stage for the Polish crisis the next year. Contrary to Chamberlain's hopes and expectations, there was no détente with Germany. And British leaders, and especially Lord Halifax, come to the conclusion that either Hitler is going to fall or war with Germany is inevitable. To a certain extent, the British are coming to think in preventive war terms. And if war is inevitable, it's better for us to have it out with them sooner rather than later, because the military balance is shifting against us. Yes, we have taken all these quite extraordinary armament measures, but for our own domestic, economic, and political reasons, we can't keep up the pace the way the Germans can. So we got to have it out with them sooner rather than later. This is Lord Halifax's view in January of 1939. As far as the general public is concerned, there's this huge hardening of British policy. Appeasement is abandoned. A policy of resistance is embraced. And what is the event that triggers that dramatic change in British attitudes? The German occupation of Prague, of the rump state of Czechoslovakia, in March of 39. And why did the Germans do this? In part because their goal is to get control of Czech and Slovak territory that they can use as bait for reaching accommodation with the Poles, and getting the Poles to side with Germany as a kind of a junior partner in a crusade against Soviet Russia. Okay? The British now move toward a policy of resistance. They're willing to accept Germany taking over now all of Czechoslovakia. But in the Polish crisis, which now develops, the British take a tough line, right? Because now we're talking about Germany annexing non-German-speaking territories, implying that there's no natural limit beyond which the Germans are unwilling to go. Right? You gotta, unless you're going to be faced with the German colossus down the road, you gotta draw the line somewhere, and we're gonna draw it at Poland. Okay. And the Poles, to Hitler's amazement, actually resist these German blandishments and are unwilling to reach any accommodation with Germany at all. And Hitler's notion is, well, you just keep raising the ante, increasing the pressure. But the Poles don't give way, and instead of Britain and France caving, British and French resistance actually hardens. Not because Chamberlain has opted for that policy, but the attitude of his cabinet colleagues and of the British public as a whole is such that the Chamberlainite policy of appeasement, is dead and can't be revived. All right, and so finally, in an act of desperation to get the British to cave, Hitler sends Ribbentrop, now his foreign minister, over to Moscow to make a deal with the Soviets. And the result is the famous Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact, the Nazi-Soviet Pact of August of 1939. The goal being to convince Britain that resistance is hopeless, because the one thing that they're counting on, namely the Soviets coming in against Germany, if war breaks out, that whole card has been taken away. But the Nazi-Soviet Pact has exactly the opposite effect on the British, because a lot of conservative types, they were leery about the idea of making a deal with the Soviets. They wanted the moral issues to be clear-cut. Okay? And with Britain not willing to give way, and Hitler basically having committed himself by getting so involved in this crisis, things finally reached the point where neither side feels that it could pull back. And the result is this war that Hitler himself didn't want. He when he receives the news of the British declaration of war, he turns to Ribbentrop and he says, in German, was nun, what do we do now? This is not a war that he wanted. It's not like 1914 where there's any equivalent of the Schlieffen Plan. They don't know how to deal with the British and the French. Yeah, they're able to beat Poland and divide Poland up with the Soviets, but now they're going to have to face this big war with Britain and France, a few years ahead of schedule, before German power has really been built up. Okay? So what does this mean about the questions that we're interested in? The Raymond Sontag, the author of A Broken World, he wrote this really amazing article. It came out in Foreign Affairs in 1957. And after having studied the documents in some depth, he reached the conclusion that this war was not a war that Hitler wanted. It was a war that resulted from a political process that drew both sides in deeper and deeper until neither side could pull back. All right? From the tangle of evidence, one theme emerges, a theme which has relevance to our own day. It is the way in which a succession of diplomatic moves, intended only as preparatory to a still distant trial of strength, developed into a diplomatic crisis involving all of Europe, and eventually precipitated a world war which at the outset Hitler had no thought of starting, and which to the end he hoped to avoid. An extremely important conclusion, because it bears very directly on the conceptual issues that we're concerned with in this class. Okay. I'm going to end with that now. Don't forget, on Friday, bring in your copy of the Taylor book, because the whole lecture on Friday will be devoted to an analysis of the Taylor book. And this is another way of getting at the same set of issues that we're interested in.